Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. A growing number of soldiers and civilians in government-controlled areas of Syria are expressing rare public disaffection with the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Non-combatants, as well as the military in traditionally loyal coastal regions, are complaining not enough is being done to relieve enclaves besieged by rebels. There is rising alarm also at the increasing presence of Tehran-backed foreign fighters from Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Iran, say political activists. In recent days, foreign Shiite fighters, along with the militiamen in the National Defense Force, dispersed young protesters by force in the port city of Tartus, according to activists working with the pro-opposition television station Halab Today. As many as 50 refugees were found dead inside a truck in Austria Thursday, as Western Balkan leaders met in Vienna to discuss ways to stem Europe's migrant crisis. An Austrian official confirmed that a tractor-trailer had been found on a highway near the town of Parndorf, but he was unable to give an exact number of people found inside the truck. The victims reportedly had suffocated. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was among leaders attending the summit, held to discuss Europe's worst migration crisis since World War II. The horrible discovery is a warning to Europe to come to grips with the migrant crisis, said Ms. Merkel. This is a warning to work to resolve this problem and show solidarity. Serbia and Macedonia have become major transit countries for tens of thousands of migrants trying to reach the EU in recent months. This is VOA News. Spokesman for rebels in South Sudan expressed doubt Thursday that President Salva Kiir is committed to a peace deal he signed the previous day. There were no reports of fighting on Thursday. While rebel and opposition leader Riek Machar is happy that Kiir signed the compromise agreement, his spokesman says the long list of reservations cited by Kiir signals a lack of commitment. The U.S. has urged both sides to honor the pact, warning of consequences for those who return to arms, and watchdog groups want strong international monitoring of the peace deal to be backed by the threat of sanctions for any violations. John Kirby is a spokesman for the U.S. State Department.
He signed it and he's committed himself to it, and our expectation is he's going to meet his commitments. Obviously, he made a personal decision to overcome his reservations and sign this agreement. Our expectation is he's going to meet his end of it. And if he doesn't, or if any party doesn't for that matter, this isn't just about President Kiir, although he's the one who's voiced the reservations, then there are options available through the UN that we will explore.
The peace pact, designed with regional leaders mediating and backed by the international community, calls for a transitional government of national unity to be established within 90 days. Machar is expected to return to South Sudan's capital, Juba, as Kiir's deputy. Kiir, who signed the deal under threat of UN sanctions after declining to do so along Machar last week, said he has concerns about the deal's provisions for sharing power and the demilitarization of Juba. National elections will be held in 2018 at the earliest, according to the agreement. The man who shot to death two U.S. television journalists during a live broadcast Wednesday sent a 23-page manifesto to a national news network in which he himself described him as a human powder keg. Vester Flanagan, 41, a former employee of the Virginia television station where the slain man and woman worked, shot himself when confronted by police. He died hours later at a local hospital, authorities said. Station WDBJ's website displayed a large black banner memorializing the victims, 24-year-old reporter Allison Parker and 27-year-old cameraman Adam Ward. A new U.S. political survey shows Donald Trump is increasing his lead in the crowded race for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. Thursday's Quinnipiac University poll showed the brash billionaire real estate mogul with 28% support among Republican voters across the country. He topped his nearest challenger, former neurosurgeon Ben Carson, who was about 15 points behind. One-time Florida Governor Jeb Bush was even further behind, as were other Republican candidates. The first party nominating contest will be in February. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Afghanistan, up to 50 were found suffocated in a tractor trailer. I believe the driver abandoned the vehicle, and these are assumed to be a part of a wave of migrants that have crossed very far away across the Mediterranean into Greece and Italy and are trying to make their way up into Northern Europe.
That's Joel Milman, a press officer for the International Organization for Migration, commenting on the latest tragedy involving migrants. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also, the UN Special Envoy to Libya says he is confident that the rival governments of Libya will sign a peace treaty within 2 weeks. And a Nigerian Senate committee is investigating charges that $5 billion has gone missing from the nation's anti-corruption commission. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, more than 100 migrants have died in separate incidents in the last 24 hours, some suffocated in a lorry on the Austrian roadside and others in the hull of a wooden boat drifting off the shores of Libya. Austrian police confirmed the deaths of about 50 migrants on a road not far from the Hungarian border. The Swedish Coast Guard vessel Poseidon found an estimated 51 bodies yesterday in the hold of a vessel containing more than 300 migrants. A two-year wave of migration across the Mediterranean to Italy and from Greece to the EU has expanded this year. EU authorities estimate that migration along these routes has almost tripled in 2015 compared to last year's numbers of 123,000. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is meeting today in Austria's capital, Vienna, with leaders from the Balkan countries to discuss a long-delayed solution to the growing migrant crisis in Europe. And as the EU members do meet in Vienna today to focus on ways to handle the huge migrant influx that is overwhelming some countries, migrant deaths continue to grow as people risk their lives fleeing war and poverty in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. The International Organization of Migration, IOM, confirms bodies of migrants were found today and yesterday. However, they say given the situation of the large number of migrants, the discoveries of the bodies were not unusual. Joel Milman is a press officer for IOM in Geneva. He spoke with me about the latest migrant tragedies that occurred in Europe and on the Mediterranean Sea.
Afghanistan, up to 50 were found suffocated in a tractor trailer. I believe the driver abandoned the vehicle, and these are assumed to be a part of a wave of migrants that have crossed very far away across the Mediterranean into Greece and Italy and are trying to make their way up into Northern Europe. Well, you know, this kind of thing is not uncommon in Latin America. We've known of deaths like this in Texas and Arizona and Mexico, so it's really not something that should surprise us. Nonetheless, it's shocking because we're talking about a population that's already crossed from very dangerous places across the Sahara Desert or into the Mediterranean, where many have drowned. So to see this happening in Europe is, you know, is quite shocking.
Also, do you have the latest figure right now on the number of migrants who are crossing into the Western Balkans?
Well, like everyone else, we've heard the figure 3,000 a day, which seems quite plausible given the volume of traffic into Greece, which is where most of these people crossing the Balkans have started out. We are up to now almost 200,000 arrivals in the Greek islands this year, which is a phenomenal increase over the last year. We are talking about 107,000, 110,000 into Italy already this year. The numbers are just really multiples greater than last year, especially with Greece. And we know that the logical destination for someone landing in Greece is one of the Western Balkan states to try to access the EU. Greece doesn't share a border with the EU the way Italy does, so it's a much more difficult transit for the migrants who arrive in the Greek islands. And we understand that there were at least 100 more deaths since, if you include the ones in the trailer today, over what we reported yesterday, which was 2,373 so far this year.
In addition, I understand there were more found in the Mediterranean yesterday. They were on a migrant ship and found by a Swedish rescue ship, the Poseidon. Could you speak on that?
Just all we've seen is from our staff in that part of the Mediterranean is 50 bodies recovered off Libya. I haven't seen anything specific specific related to the provenance of the ship that saved them, but this is a pretty standard number for what's been happening in that part of the Mediterranean. We know the bodies are supposed to be brought to Sicily this evening. That's the most we've heard.
Do you know where these particular migrants were from?
Probably sub-Saharan Africa. That seems to be the largest group that's leaving Libya now. You know, a year ago, close to 30,000 Syrians had left Libya for Italy. This year, just 6,000 have. Most of the traffic from Syria has moved over to Turkey and Greece, but most of what's coming through Libya is the Horn of Africa, especially Somalia and Eritrea, and then West Africa. Countries like Nigeria and others are the most prominent.
Are the countries that they're going into, are they able to handle and process the migrants? And I know some countries are affected more than other countries.
Well, really, only two countries are the first destination, which is Italy and Greece. A handful have gone to Malta and a couple of thousand to Spain, but those are the two big ones. And many of those migrants don't stay even as much as a week, especially if they're from countries like Syria, where there's a strong chance of gaining resettlement and asylum, you know, in a country further north. They rarely stay in Italy more than a few days. In Greece, they stay only as long as they have to, because it can be difficult to get off the islands once you're landed, because it's tourist season and a lot of the capacity of regular ferry service to the mainland is taken up by tourists. But we know in general these migrants aren't interested in staying very long in these two countries. And some do. Some end up, because they have limited choices, some actually do end up staying up to a year or so. But in general, they're moving pretty quickly to where they want to go, which is usually where they think they can find family members or a job or both.
That was Joel Millman, a press officer for the International Organization for Migration. He spoke with me from Geneva. The UN Special Envoy to Libya says he is confident that the rival governments of Libya will sign a peace treaty within 2 weeks. Bernardino Leon says delegates from rival governments in the capital Tripoli and the port of Tobruk have never been as close to an agreement as they are now. Leon meets today in Morocco with Libyan groups to discuss a UN proposal for a one-year unity government. The government would be composed of a council of ministers, a prime minister, and two deputies. Competing factions split the country after the death of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Leon has been holding talks between opposing governments and many militias for 11 months. International aid organizations have welcomed the signing by President Kiir of the agreement to end the conflict in South Sudan. Oxfam, the International Rescue Committee, World Vision, and CARE say the peace deal must be fully implemented in order for aid agencies to be able to reach people in dire need. Reporter Philip Thon-Aliou spoke to the heads of two aid agencies in South Sudan and reports from Juba.
The head of the IRC in South Sudan says having Mr. Kiir's signature on the agreement can only be a good thing. But says Ronald Paul Bayeo, the terms of the agreement must be respected by all sides for it to have a positive impact on people's lives. He says that is likely to be a harder task than getting all of the parties to the conflict to sign the deal.
We understand that South Sudan is a complex context. The peace agreement is complicated as well, so it's going to take cooperation between all the involved parties to make the implementation with the international community. We are optimistic. We hope these recommendations will be put in place, but we understand that it won't be easy.
Bayou says a permanent ceasefire is needed immediately to enable humanitarian agencies to reach people who need help. The agreement says a ceasefire will begin 72 hours after Mr. Kiir signed the deal, in other words, on Saturday. Bayeo says without a guarantee that the fighting will stop, it will continue to be difficult to deliver food and education supplies to the 1.6 million people who are displaced inside South Sudan.
We will have better access to all of South Sudan, especially isolated areas where there are some vulnerable populations who need some assistance. So having that access now is great. South Sudan has difficulty when it comes to logistics. for roads, using waterways and using the air to ship goods to the field. So we hope that with the ceasefire and the demobilization of armed actors, we will have better access so we can deliver our services in the field, in conjunction, of course, with the different governmental authorities which we work with.
Zlako Gigich is the head of Oxfam International in South Sudan. He says he hopes the compromise peace deal that Mr. Kiir signed yesterday will stop violence against civilians and allow aid workers to safely assist people in need.
Many of our staff, as well as our colleagues from other agencies, have been harassed, detained, and in some cases, unfortunately, killed. That brought up a huge problem to aid agencies to deliver all those life-saving assistances, forcing us to withdraw our staff and suspend operations in a number of areas of South Sudan. That exposed hundreds of thousands of people who are already in dire situation in terrible conditions to be cut off of even those basic life-saving assistances.
Gigich says he looks forward to the situation in South Sudan changing for the better now that Mr. Kiir has added his signature to the peace deal. He says once there is a ceasefire, Oxfam staff will be redeployed to the countryside to help civilians who have suffered greatly during the 20-month conflict.
We are talking about millions of people who are in very severe food situation. So health services, food and clean water to prevent outbreak of deadly diseases is definitely the first and immediate need.
The United Nations estimates that around 4.6 million people in South Sudan are severely food insecure, an increase of nearly 1 million from the same time last year. Aid agencies have been unable to reach many of the people in need in South Sudan because of poor infrastructure and the lack of security caused by the conflict. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleo in Juba.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. More than 100 migrants have died in separate incidents in the last 24 hours. International aid organizations have welcomed the signing by President Kiir of the agreement to end the conflict in South Sudan. And for more news and information, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. In more news around the continent, a Nigerian Senate committee is investigating charges that $5 billion has gone missing from the nation's anti-corruption commission. Commission Chairman Ibrahim Lamorde, a former policeman appointed by ex-president Goodluck Jonathan, denies the charges. He calls it a smear campaign by members of the Senate. Senate President Bukola Saraki denies any political motives for the investigation. However, Saraki himself is being investigated on fraud charges by the Anti-Corruption Commission. A new study shows that redesigning medical services for tuberculosis can dramatically reduce the death rate. The research was conducted in a local health district in Togo. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
TB is blamed for 2 million deaths every year. Most of them are in developing countries. It's also the second leading cause of death among infectious diseases. Over the years, TB and HIV have been closely linked because TB easily infects those with weakened immune systems. Also, new drug-resistant strains of TB have arisen, often making treatment difficult and painful, and sometimes ineffective. But a study in Togo reports a 10% drop in TB deaths following changes in services in the Locks Health District. It's located in the country's southern maritime region. Dr. Kosivi Afanvi works for Togo's Ministry of Health. He was health director of the Locks District from 2008 to 2015. He says when he arrived, there was much room for improvement in the treatment of TB.
The treatment rate of tuberculosis was very, very low, at 80%. And the death rate was very, very high, at 13%.
Afanvi is the lead author of the Togo study, appearing in BMJ Quality Improvement Reports. He had received training from the Boston-based Institute for Healthcare Improvement, a nonprofit organization. In 2012, Afanvi implemented what's called a system quality improvement model in LACS.
So we decided to increase the treatment success rate to at least 85% and to reduce the mortality rate to 5%.
2 years later, the program exceeded its goals. The mortality rate quickly fell from 13 to 3%. And by the time he took a new job early this year, he says there were no TB deaths in the Locks District. There's a hospital and more than 30 health clinics in Locks. The model called for increasing TB screening in every location where there was a registered nurse. If a test is positive, it's followed by intensive treatment. What's more, screening was also done for HIV. Treating those infected with the AIDS virus can strengthen their immune systems and, in turn, make them better able to defend against TB. Dr. Afanvi is now in charge of the neighboring Vo Health District, where he's also implemented the system quality improvement model.
In my new district, I decided to use the model to manage other programs. I came here in February, and according to the immunization program, the rate was at 75, but actually we are at 91 for vaccinating or immunizing children.
And the TB death rate has also dropped sharply in Vo. Afanvi has recommended to Togo's Ministry of Health that the model be applied to the entire country. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The New York Forum Africa begins tomorrow in Libreville, Gabon. It brings together political and business leaders, NGO representatives, and youth to share ideas to help the continent advance economically. Richard Uttas is the forum's founder and director. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips about the three-day invitation-only gathering, which he promises will be a complex affair based on some simple goals.
The New York Forum Africa is probably today the largest economic conference happening in Africa, addressing the major issues that the global economy is facing in Africa and trying to find solutions. Its purpose is also to help to change the perception of Africa, but also to address not just the opportunities, but also to be very transparent and to address the issues and the challenges that the continent is facing. It was decided 4 years ago to host it in Gabon, in Libreville, by the invitation of His Excellency, the President Ali Bongo Ondimba. So the Gabonese government is taking the financial, I would say, investment to host this conference and to make it a Pan-African dialogue.
Why is it called the New York Forum Africa?
I started the New York Forum in New York in 2009, which is still happening every year in New York, which was addressing the global issues and the major issue that the global economy is facing. But one piece was missing. Always, the African dimension, because to really understand Africa, you need to be there. So we brought the spirit of New York to Africa, the resilience, the dynamic, and always a call to action and solution-oriented.
Who are the stakeholders in this? Are they people on the ground? Is it altruistic, humanitarian exercise, or more of a business investment thing?
For the past 4 years, we are hosting more or less 1,500 people. I would say that 60% of the audience is coming from Africa and 40% of the audience is coming from outside the continent. And the audience of the New York Forum Africa is business leaders, investors, media leaders. We have NGOs, experts, and political leaders. We are hosting few heads of states every year and former heads of state, but more importantly, 40% of the audience are youth, entrepreneurs, students, people who are looking for new inspiration. We have the conviction that the best project for the continent will happen only if it's going through public-private partnership. But at the same time, we are also trying to promote entrepreneurship, which is trying to really promote the voice of the youth. What are their hopes? What can we do to help them to get a job? What advice should we give them for a better education system to help them to find a job one day? At the same time, this year, we're also addressing the issue of climate change for Africa. This is why this year we try to have a team focused on the energy of the continent. For me, who was born in Africa, who was born in North Africa, in Morocco, I know that the main asset of our continent are the human resources, the people of Africa, the talent of Africa. This is the real energy of the continent, the energy of women, of the African people in the continent, from Morocco to South Africa and from Ghana to Ethiopia.
One concern that some people might have is, you know, for example, the presence of China. They've been criticized for going in there, making lots of, investment in terms of extracting resources, but that the local people often aren't the beneficiaries of it. It ends up leaving the continent and enriching others.
Okay, so last year we sent a very strong message, supported, by the way, by the president of Gabon. Number one, the Africa transformation should happen by transforming natural resources in Africa. This is the only way to create jobs in Africa. So if you want to operate on natural resources, on mining, on wood, on all these resources, you have to accept to transform them in the continent. This is the only way to create jobs. Yes, foreign investors are most than welcome. They are needed. But we have to give priority to projects which are creating local jobs. And this could happen in many fields, agriculture, energy, renewable energy. We consider that Africa, it is the land of joint ventures. We could have Chinese, Americans, Europeans working together with African people for the benefit of Africa and for the benefit of the foreign investors. And it could be an amazing platform, a bridge between the East and the West.
Richard Uttis is the founder and director of the New York Forum Africa. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. More than 100 migrants have died in separate incidents in the last 24 hours. International aid organizations welcome the signing by President Kiir of the agreement to end the conflict in South Sudan. And a Nigerian Senate committee investigates charges that $5 billion has gone missing from the nation's anti-corruption commission. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, we'll look into cataracts, the leading cause of blindness in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand World Athletics tops your sports report today.
Kim, we're going to begin with Jamaica's Lightning Bolt.
I'm Lightning Bolt. I'm not flash guarding anybody. My name is Lightning Bolt.
The Lightning Bolt. Usain Bolt blazed to his record fourth consecutive world 200-meter title on Thursday in Beijing, China, 4 days after beating American Justin Gatlin in the 100 meters. Bolt did it again in the 200 meters, clocking 19.55 seconds, the fastest time in the world this year. Gatlin won the silver medal in 19.74 seconds, and South Africa's Anaso Jobodwana set a national record of 19.87 seconds in winning the bronze medal. The 23-year-old Jobodwana was the only African medal winner on the sixth day of competition at the World Athletics Championships. The USA won gold Thursday in the women's 400 meters and the men's triple jump. American star Allyson Felix ran the fastest time in the world this year in winning the 400 meters in 49.26 seconds. It was the ninth world title for Allyson, who is also a four-time Olympic champion. In the men's triple jump, American Christian Taylor had a gold medal-winning leap of 18.21 meters. In one other final on Thursday, world record holder Anita Wolodziec of Poland won the women's hammer throw in 80.85 meters. It was the second longest hammer throw of all time by a woman. Earlier this month, at a meet in her native Poland, Anita set a new world record with a throw of 81.08 meters. Meanwhile, getting back to world record holder Usain Bolt, his victory on Thursday in the 200 meters gave him a record-extending 10th World Championship gold medal, and Bolt could win an 11th gold before he leaves Beijing. He's scheduled to race again on Saturday as part of Jamaica's 4x100-meter relay team.
I'm Lightning Bolt. I'm not flash guarding anybody. My name is Lightning Bolt.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Uganda's freestyle kayaking team is known for braving some of the largest rapids on the Nile. This year, the team qualified for the World Championships, which are scheduled to take place in Canada from August 30th to September 5th. However, getting to Canada proved to be a real journey for the Ugandan kayakers. Elizabeth Pola tells us more from the capital, Kampala.
Last November, Uganda's kayaking community celebrated when four of its members, Amina Tayona, David Agessa, Sadat Kawawa, and Yusuf Basalirwa, qualified to compete in the IFC World Freestyle Kayak Championships. Their hopes of attending the event were nearly dashed. The visa applications were initially denied over questions regarding the athletes' personal assets and whether they would leave Canada. Undaunted, they reapplied. This time, the applications included land titles, trading licenses, student enrollments, cover letters, and even bank account information from their coach. But the applications were rejected again. The kayakers debated whether to give up, but soon their story spread. Canadians wrote to their MPs, appealed to the consulate, and broad social media campaigns helped bring people like Robert Zoenberg, the chair of the Canadian Freestyle Kayaking Committee, in to champion the athletes' cause. Visa applications were submitted again. This time, the applications were approved, but Jacques Depignard, who helped manage the visa arrangements, says that there was one more hurdle to overcome, and that it involved the money to book the flights.
With all the visa stuff, we hadn't bought the flights until we had the visas confirmed. Combine that with all the visa money that basically got spent, we were short about $5,000 total.
A crowdfunding campaign helped make up the shortfall. Competitor Sadat Kawawa says the team has been welcomed warmly in Canada.
Yeah, people are really, really friendly, and the way people came out and helped in everything, it's unbelievable. Everyone is very, very happy to see us, and we're also happy to see everyone. It's a nice moment for me, for Uganda, for Africa.
The championship will be streamed live. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Basketball news now on the Voice of America. Nigeria beat Gabon Thursday 88-64 to advance to the semifinals at the African Men's Basketball Championship in Tunisia. Al-Farouq Aminu, a forward for the Portland Trail Blazers in the National Basketball Association, led the Nigerian team with a team-high 17 points and a game-high 10 rebounds. The Nigerian men were never threatened by the Gabonese. Nigeria comfortably won each of the four quarters of the game. Gil Terrence Mayimba scored a game-high 21 points for Gabon. In Thursday's other quarterfinal matchups, Egypt is playing Angola, Senegal is going against Algeria, and in the last game of the evening, Tunisia is hosting Mali. The semifinals are scheduled for Saturday, and the winners of those two games on Saturday will advance to Sunday's final in Rades, located just outside Tunisia's capital, Tunis. Remember, VOA basketball fans, the winner of Sunday's championship game will represent Africa at next year's Olympic men's basketball tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
We'll be right back.
Kemi Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
You need to get to the net. And this reminder for our VOA basketball fans, the Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo will be officially enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame on September 11th. Now let's go to New York City, where the year's final Grand Slam tennis tournament, the U.S. Open, begins on Monday. One of the favorites for the men's singles title is Novak Djokovic, the world number one from Serbia, who has won 9 Grand Slam titles in his great career, including the U.S. Open in 2011. In New York on Wednesday, Djokovic received another honor. He was officially named a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. UNICEF's Deputy Executive Director is Yoka Brandt.
So in recognition of his deep commitment to children, UNICEF is excited to welcome Novak to our Global Goodwill Ambassador family, and I'm sure together we will reach the most vulnerable children with early childhood development. And with Novak's winning ways, we will give every child everywhere not just a fair start, but the best start, and pave the way for a better future for all.
In terms of creating a better future for children, Novak Djokovic had this to say.
It's about dreaming first and really believing in your dreams. I think every child should be encouraged to dream and should be given an opportunity to dream. Unfortunately, in my country and in many disadvantaged rural areas around the world, children live in such circumstances and they're discouraged to dream. Unfortunately, also led by fear and some social barriers to pursue their dreams. But I think that would be the first and utmost importance advice, to dream and to really be brave enough and to have courage to really live in your imagination and to visualize yourself of becoming somebody or something that you really want to become.
That's Novak Djokovic, the world's number one ranked men's tennis player, speaking at a news conference in New York about his new role as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. Djokovic is in New York to compete at the U.S. Open, which begins on Monday. Croatia's Marin Cilic is the defending men's champion in New York, while Serena Williams is the defending women's champion. Serena has dominated in 2015, having already won Australian Open, French Open, and Wimbledon titles. If she can win her 4th consecutive U.S. Open title, she'll become the first player since Steffi Graf in 1988 to win all 4 major tournaments in the same year. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, we'll look into cataracts, the leading cause of blindness in Africa. And also, funerals are big business in Zimbabwe. But first, some music. Here's Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Used to cruise me around in your car, but thank God I got my own home. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. So why you the envy? Used to pay my bills before, but now I they pay for two. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that, brother man, to the envy. Unya yanka, that they be allowed in it, size a pet any baller. But man no be God, man no be God, stop all the hating. Lie, lie, man just be man, so you never know why. My destiny changing, I'm living so high. Make you no envy my sign, because where they bless me. Gunshots, one man down, on to the next one, oh yeah. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots, one man down, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back.
The DJs, they they blame my song. The fellas be loving, they hailing my song. The ladies, they dancing, they using my song for their ringtone. You never thought about that. No, I'm staying on top forever. Whether you short or you tall, rich or you poor, time keep changing for better. And you can't do nothing about it. Another man rain of fighting. Because you know be God. And you never saw me past God. Cause that one, no one on yabala man. It doesn't when it feels just right. Don't you say it's never my type. So make you know they look down on another brother man. Ha. Let go. Gunshots.
One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah.
Said I would shrivel, said I'd be dead if I ever tried to whistle. But hey, who said it was simple? The feds take your bread so you wouldn't make a nickel. You mean I couldn't pick a pickle? Pick words when I could've picked a pistol? A sick verse, the out of cells got him sickle. Blowing all up in your face like a pimple. Now he said, she said he ain't hit. And if he ain't hit, that's cause he ain't rich. And if he ain't rich, check who he came with. I don't play with this, he say and she say, shh. Get off my
one man crown, another man crown. Why? Because him want you down. They say one man crown, and another man frown. Why? Because him want you down. But guess what? Gunshots. One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Hey, another man down. Oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down. Oh yeah, no gaba.
Joel with One Man Down. Well, cataracts are a clouding of the lens of the eye that can slowly lead to loss of vision. They are also the leading cause of blindness in Africa and Latin America. The World Health Organization says 39 million people in the world are blind and 246 million have low vision. Most of this suffering occurs in developing countries. Jacob Mohan Thaznatu is president and CEO of Help Me See, an organization whose goal is to eliminate blindness caused by cataracts. He talked to VOA's Lenore Madu about a new campaign being launched in Madagascar.
Africa is an emerging continent of the 21st century with 1.2 billion population and about 6 million people, and according to our estimates, blind due to cataract. In Madagascar, among the 21 million people, we estimate there are at least about a million people who will need the support for cataract surgery in the next 5 to 6 years. And our goal is to eliminate cataract blindness in Madagascar. And we just launched the Madagascar campaign in the 2 weeks ago. Our goal is to train. And the first goal is to train at least about 15 to 20 cataract surgeons in Madagascar in partnership with the Ministry of Health, the Lions Club in Madagascar, the Lions West program, and with the Help Me See technology. The Help Me See technology is based on simulator-based training. The simulators are aviation-grade, high-fidelity simulators which can train cataract surgeons to proficiency. And along with our surgical kit technology, which eliminates infection rates, introducing a community-based surveillance system. Okay. We expect to achieve that in Madagascar.
Okay, now what type of challenges have you come across as you work in these countries?
The biggest challenge is lack of adequately trained cataract specialists. The medical surgical training requires to be significantly improved. And there are very, very few number of surgeons against the number of population who requires those surgeries. In generally speaking, in most of the countries in Africa, there is less than one ophthalmologist for a million population. That need to change.
And you will have achieved about 200,000 surgeries, am I correct, in Madagascar?
That's correct. Help Me See has supported 200,000 surgeries, and the 200,000th surgery was done in Madagascar in the hospital in Antananarivo by Dr. Amy and one patient, Madame Florentine, living in Antananarivo. Now, that's a level of information that we can provide to the local surgical partners and to the local community so that they can solve the problem.
That was Jacob Mohanthasnatu, the president and CEO of Help Me See. He was speaking with reporter Lenore Madu. Well, funerals have become a big business in Zimbabwe, with many small-scale business people turning to coffin production to feed their families. Tarai Shaba reports from the city of Bulawayo.
Zimbabweans, like other people across the world, respect the dead and try as much as possible to ensure that when their loved ones die, they are given a decent burial. In a country grappling with dire economic problems, such decency is often put to the test, as burying the dead is relatively costly, especially in urban areas. For many years, the funeral services sector has been dominated by a few established companies with branches in most cities and towns. In Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, a number of small funeral parlors have sprung up over the years, mostly in the Kelvin North Industrial Area, which is within the vicinity of high-density suburbs like Pelandaba, Magwegwe, Mpopoma, Nkulumane, Pumula, and Lobengula. One of the companies is Exodus Funeral Services. Founder and director Charles Chuwake says he started the company in 2007 after working as a driver for a big funeral company. Chuwake says he formed the company after realizing that funeral services offered by big companies were out of reach for most ordinary people. The company's client services manager, Winnie Lovu, says they are targeting low-income groups.
We're looking at people who are unemployed, those that are selling in the street. We're looking at people that are in the flea markets who are selling. We're looking at people who are selling even tomatoes. We're looking at people that are just doing things on their own to make life go on. Because with us, you can come straight to us and pay your premium. We allow people to form associations like bearer societies. And then from there, they work together.
Lovu says Exodus Funeral Services allows funeral policy holders who pay an average of $15 per month to include children over the age of 21, unlike some big companies that have age restrictions on such dependents. There are some instances in which some small funeral companies reportedly fail to provide expected services to clients, mainly due to lack of the requisite capacity. But Juake says his company offers an array of services similar to those offered by bigger companies, adding that it has never encountered any problems in providing service to clients.
Well, the services which we provide here, we are just doing the same as those big guns. We are in the same field, we are doing the same, but basically what we normally offer, we are manufacturing our own coffins, we do the coffins, we do the body washing, we've got the mortuary.
Another indigenous company operating in the highly competitive funeral services sector is Flair Funeral Services, which was established a few years ago by former foreign currency dealer and cross-border trader Swongile Dube. Dube says the company is breaking even, though competition is getting stiff every day. The expanding funeral services sector has also boosted the operations of informal coffin-making businesses in the city. 27-year-old Neva Onye, a coffin maker at the Mashumba home industry in Nguboyenja high-density suburb, used to work at a private funeral parlor as a casual laborer. He says he makes about 20 ordinary coffins a month, being sold for $50, and a few caskets that fetch up to $400 each. Another coffin maker, Kelvin Tembo, who started making coffins 2 years ago, says he learned basic carpentry at high school and perfected his skills through learning from some of the experienced carpenters at Mashumba. Like his colleagues, Tembo, a father of two, sells the coffins directly to individual clients and funeral service companies.
A day you can make about 10 coffins, depend on how customers comes here. We can sell about, we depend on touters. There are touters here, so we can manage to talk to the touters there. We can manage to sell about 7 a day coffins. There are different types of coffins. There are dooms and budget. Those ones are cheap. Budget, they are cheap. Like this one here that I'm scraping here.
Despite this lucrative business, the Bulawayo City Council is not benefiting much from these operations, as it is getting little revenue from this sector, which includes the provision of graves to all bereaved families. Mayor Martin Moyo explains.
The figures I have here for last month, we had, say, 381 deaths. I'm not so sure of the price of a grave, but if it's, say, $50 per grave, so you are saying 381 times 50. So it's really not a lot of money.
Although death haunts many people, it appears as if coffin making and burial services are the only lucrative business in a city ravaged by Zimbabwe's harsh economic environment. Most big companies have shut down in the city, once considered the country's industrial hub. Reporting from Bulawayo, this is Taurai Shava.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government of Guinea and two main opposition parties there have signed an agreement to settle their dispute over terms of the upcoming presidential election, raising hopes of an inclusive and peaceful vote. The deal, reached after weeks of informal talks, allows for representation in local communal councils to reflect results of the 2013 legislative election. As part of the agreement, the government pledged to give the opposition representation in 128 of Guinea's 343 districts. The agreement also addresses the opposition's concern about the integrity of voter registration lists. The government agreed to establish a technical committee attached to the National Independent Electoral Commission to review the lists. Finally, there was agreement to replace two recently deceased members of the commission with opposition members. Guinea has made solid progress since its democratic transition in November 2010, but the terms of the October 11th presidential elections have been in dispute. The opposition has staged protests, some resulting in injuries and several deaths. The United States commends the agreement reached between Guinea's ruling and opposition political parties, which clears the way for Guinea to hold the first round of presidential elections next month. The government and opposition political parties demonstrated goodwill, flexibility, and a shared commitment to holding credible, inclusive, and peaceful elections. We remain committed to supporting the electoral process and urge the parties to continue dialogue throughout the election period, committing themselves and their supporters to nonviolence. We encourage all parties to build on this positive development by working together to prepare for the elections according to the new agreement. The United States sees a role for all Ghanaians in standing together at this important moment and ensuring the upcoming elections unify the nation and strengthen its democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share the ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.